Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest Mary Ruffel. Her selected poems just came out, and I have to confess, I started reading Mary Ruffel fairly recently, in that she has around, 13 books of various sorts, and I started on around her eighth. Her selected poems, well, they give you the things that you will love about Mary Ruffel, in particular the quality of surprise and enchantment. I found myself being delighted by the poems before I knew anything about them. And before I tell you anything about them, I thought that it would be more interesting for you to hear her voice in a series of poems, because secretly, I find that her technique is something that I would call the pump of the imagination. The imagination gets pressed like a spigot on a chocolate syrup jar, and the poem demands that the imagination keep working, and if not, she'll keep pumping. And when you hear her voice in poem after poem, you'll grow familiar with this quality, and by the time you're finished hearing them, I think, like me, you'll be in love.
Kiss of the Sun. If, as they say, poetry is a sign of something among people, then let this be prearranged now between us while we are still peoples. That at the end of time, which is also the end of poetry and wheat and evil and insects and love, when the entire human race gathers in the flesh, reconstituted down to the infant's tiniest fold and littlest nail, I will be standing at the edge of that fathomless crowd with an orange for you, reconstituted down to its innermost seed protected by white thread, in case you are thirsty, which does not at this time seem like such a wild guess. And though there will be no poetry between us then, at the end of time, the geese all gone with the seas, I hope you will take it, and remember on earth I did not know how to touch it, it was all so raw. And if by chance there is no edge to the crowd or anything else, so that I am of it, I will take the orange and toss it as high as I can. Quick note about the think source. My dreams are not worth a half penny. A battery cut in two, 80 orange roses, an old boyfriend in a new car of the kind he would never drive. Fortunately for us, the universe is not that complicated. Eventually, words like torpor and muddle came into being, and then torpid, muddled accounts of the universe took over the populace, many of whom died while it was snowing. There is always someone willing to tell you who they are, though it takes a little time to find the professional, but much less than if you had to do the reading yourself. If you are planning on being born, you should know there was a primordial abundance of helium. If something remains in the same position for 9 consecutive days, it is safe to assume it has passed, and that oleanders really do grow along the Oxus, which is a river. After that, you are free to pursue the violent activity of happiness. But for the universe, after the first 3 minutes, nothing of interest occurred for 700,000 years. It just went on cooling and expanding as if it were asleep on a premium mattress until it felt cold enough to wake up and make stars. The rest is almost history. Volcanic holes, small French paintings, one-eyed bats, a handwritten note wedged between the doors of a church. And oh, one more thing. When asked, if you say, "I do not dance," the next day an infant is born without feet.
Mary Ruffel reading from her selected poems. Now, if you could see me, listeners, I'm smiling like a loon, and I hope that you are, but if you are not yet, this is a real favorite.
Why I am not a good kisser. Because I open my mouth too wide, trying to take in the curtains behind us and everything outside the window except the little black dog who does not like me, so at the last moment I shut my mouth. Because Cipriano Durore was not thinking when he wrote his sacred and secular motets, or there would be only one kind, and this affects my lips in terrible ways. Because at the last minute I see a lemon sitting on a gravestone, and that is a thing that would appear impossible, and the kiss is already concluded in its entirety. Because I learned everything about the beautiful in A Guide to the Weather by Boren Van Loon, so the nature of lenticular clouds and anticyclones and several other things dovetail in my mind, and at once it strikes me what quality goes to form a good kisser, especially at this moment, and which you possess so enormously. I mean, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts without me, I am dreadfully afraid he will slip away while my kiss is trying to think what to do. Because I think you will try to read what is written on my tongue, and this causes me to interrupt with questions. A red frock, red stockings, and the rooster dead? Dead of what? Because of that other woman inside me who knows how the red skirt and red stockings came into my mouth, but persists with the annoying questions leading to her genuine ignorance. Because just when our teeth are ready to hide, I become a quisling and forget the election results and industrial secrets leading to the manufacture of woolen ice cream cones, changing the futures of ice worms everywhere. Can it be that even the greatest kisser ever arrived at his goal without putting aside numerous objections? Because every kiss is like throwing a pair of doll eyes into the air and trying to follow them with your own. However it may be, oh, for a life of kisses instead of painting volcanoes. Even if my kiss is like a paintbrush made from hairs, even if my kiss is squaw root, which is a scaly herb of the broom rape family, parasitic on oaks, even if a sailor went to sea in me to see what he could see in me, and all that he could see in me was the bottom of the deep dark sea in me, even though I know nothing can be gained by running screaming into the night like a mouth, into the mouth like a velvet movie theater with planets painted on its ceilings, where you will find me, your podmate, in some kind of beautiful trouble over moccasin stitch number 3, which is required for my release.
That's Mary Ruffel reading from her selected poems. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Mary Ruffel is one of the creators of delight. I'm very happy to have her on the show. It's a special kind of poetry, it seems to me. I think that some of its cousins and grandparents include Blake in part, but more recently James Tate and Darrow Weir and John Ashbery. It's got my heart. In its best interests. And that's always a relief in poetry, because I was taught when I was young to kind of fear it, that I wouldn't understand it. What was your experience of poetry when you were young?
When I was young, I was very lonely, and I found like-minded friends in books, and my favorite books were books of poems, which I started reading at a very young age, maybe second grade. I remember loving the A.A. Milne poetry series, When We Were Six. When we were very young, now we are six. And reading them again and again and again. And then an anthology that Louis Untermeyer edited called A Golden Treasury of Verse. Many of the poems in there were over my head. I didn't understand them, but I loved them. It was many years until I understood that understanding poetry has nothing to do with understanding, but if it's given you pleasure, you've understood it. But somehow the seeds of that, my intuition was already seeded in the beginning. And I was frightened of adults. I was frightened of the world around me. I was never frightened when I was reading poems. I was never frightened.
Your name is pronounced Rufel and spelled R-U-E-F-L-E, and the selected poems is published by Wave Books for people who are even now rushing to find out how to get this in between their hot paws. I think of ruefulness as being a particularly poetic sensation. What might have been?
It is. The English word, if you spell it differently, it's the English word for sorrow or sadness. With rue my heart is laden, and to be rueful is to be full of sadness. Actually, my surname is Swabian, a southern Black Forest region of Germany, and for years I wanted to know what it meant. I was curious if it had any connotations of sadness in its original language, and I found out that it meant a little cry, but that could be a little cry as in, oh, then I immediately assumed my ancestors were town criers. So that I came from a long line of town criers, someone wandering the gated village with a lantern in their hand, crying out that all was well or not. Rueful. And Mary, the English name Mary means full of sorrow.
Does it? I didn't really
know
that.
Yeah, its name, it's full of sorrow. So it's full of sorrow, my name is full of sorrow, full of sorrow.
But what's interesting to me is that while they are melancholy and even rueful, I detect happiness in these poems.
I hope that you do. I hope that the reader sees as much joy as sadness in them. Actually, I was being interviewed some years ago, and an interviewer said to me, asked me a very embarrassing question. They said, "The word lonely appears in your poems a lot. Why is that?" And I don't remember the answer I gave. It happened suddenly, and I wasn't thinking too quickly on my feet, but I immediately went home and wrote a poem, called Q&A, which is, a very funny, joyful poem about why the word lonely appears in so many poems. So I hope there's a mix of the two, as they are not exclusive of each other, but like all things in life and on earth, interdependent.
I think that it's also that poets tend to come to an acceptance of loneliness and sadness before other people do, it seems to me, or to see that something can be done with them. Hey, I'll put them in a poem. And then if you're of addled mind, the way many of us, both poets and readers, are, you might regard the poem as a friend, as a healing of a loneliness. And so you've had the ingenuity to solve the problem.
Yes. And again, my first encounters with poetry were, here's a very addled mind, and it's calmed me down. You know, an agitated mind, a curious mind, a moving, shimmering, alive mind calmed me down. And I think there are more sorrowful poems in the universe than unsorrowful, probably 48% to 51%, but still. And it doesn't make any difference, because sadness is part of the human condition. And in our culture, we fight that. We don't recognize it. We don't acknowledge it. We seem to think there's something wrong with it, so you can seek distractions, you can take pills, you can do any number of things. And in fact, going with the flow works just as well as any other way.
Now, I find your poems incredibly demanding, but the demand seems to be being placed on the poet, that in practically every line there's a new surprise. Therefore, I kind of use that idea of the spigot or the pump. Does that kind of poetry, I think it argues that you have a different kind of mind, because as you go through the book, the poems don't seem to tire you out. You know, there are certain kinds of poets who speak of the process of poetry itself as wasting them, exhausting or debilitating even, that they have to rest for it. I think Rilke talks about resting for something like 20 years so that when the angels came to him, he would have the stamina to take down what they wanted him to say. Is it that way for you? Do you feel a refreshment, it seems, from poetry?
I live a very reclusive, solitary life in general. So my case may be a little different because that kind of quietude and restfulness is already my environment. I don't have to leave another environment to enter that. I'm already in it. And, my poems always begin with lines popping into my head, and they just pop into my head, and it's a gift, and I'm thankful, and I pick up a pencil or pen and start scribbling, and there's no activity on earth that makes me happier, and there is nothing I would rather be doing. How do I feel afterwards? Do I feel depleted or exhausted? No, I feel energized. I usually feel depleted 48 hours later, you know, when I read the latest poem and find out it's, you know, not the best thing that's ever been written, you know, which we all have to think at the moment of composition. It's part of composing, is that illusion is integral to composing. It's just an illusion, but I know I always feel energized after I've written a poem or a prose piece or engaged in any form of making art.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Mary Ruffel about her new collection, Selected Poems. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mary Ruffel, and I take great pleasure in her selected poems, which seem to me to be generated by a mind constantly alive and really in love with its own procedures. But there's another form that she uses. She finds books, kind of antiquarian books, used books that are, you know, kind of rotting along the edges of their pages. They tend to be a little bit orangey. She takes white out and she sculpts poems page by page out of what she finds in these odd books. And I think it's a really beautifully balanced process because on the one hand, your poems seem to kind of accrete and bubble like a kind of foam. And these are poems that are made tinier and tinier by the process of covering the page with whiteout. The Wave Press also did us an immense favor because they published a book that is a facsimile book called A Little White Shadow. That's really the title of the pamphlet. And it's hilarious because all this white shadow covers the pages. Would you read a couple of the resulting poems? But what's great is because it's a facsimile, you see these yellowed pages and you can tell what kind of religious tract the poems were sculpted from. They're really like the project of emptying the mind rather than filling it, and it's very delightful.
7 centuries of sobbing gathered in the twilight and had their pages wandered through. The dead borrow so little from the past as if they were alive. On the German piano, birds were singing in the language which some believe he wrote after he drew the portrait of her. 3 weeks later brought us news of September, married very quietly to Rome on her way back to Russia. They had been at a loss for a subject at first, but had finally chosen Looking Down the Road as if waiting for a new volume of Browning.
They're so great. You know, all of these words were in the original text, and painted out are all the unnecessary words, as if there were a spirit yearning to be freed from these pages, and these very brief poems emerge. You can also see some of the longer books. They've gotten quite elaborate on Mary Ruffel's website, which is, what is the address? Do you know it by heart?
It's maryruffel.com, all lowercase, all one word.
And they're beautiful, and they are shown in museums and collected, and ought to be. They're part of a tradition, too, that poetry is now calling erasure, but it's been going on for quite some time. One poet did an erasure of Shakespeare's sonnets, and there have been many erasures in recent modern poetry, and I've been wondering in a certain way whether this has become popular because of the general feeling of amnesia in the culture, the feeling that some kind of fog is settling on our brains and erasing our senses of the past, of history, of what we did yesterday. It seems to be a common complaint, and people have edited anthologies with titles like The Culture of Amnesia.
Yes. I can't speak for other people. I know erasure is very, very popular. There is apparently an erasure scene. I don't consider myself part of it, mainly because I don't own a computer and don't go out much. Therefore, I'm not really hooked in. I know, because of my own personal passion for doing this thing called erasure, I know how much fun it is. For me, the idea of amnesia and forgetting, well, I once gave a little lecture on erasure, and I think towards the end I began to talk about, or I began to directly address the people in the audience who I knew were vehemently disinterested, uninterested, and bored by erasure. Many, many people are very dismissive of it and don't take it seriously. And I said to them, you may think this is an artsy fad, but I can assure you that the older you get, as your memories grow, earlier memories have to drop off. There's not room for everything. And eventually, on your deathbed, your memories and the words you are able to speak, there is a natural process of erasure in every human life. So at the very end, whatever your final words are, those are the only words coming through the page of everything you've ever spoken in your life, or the one singular sentence that began with your first words and will end with your last. I don't mean to be morbid about it, but amnesia is, there is the negative spin, the cultural spin on amnesia, but there's also the deeply universal human side of it, which again, one hopefully finds a way to make peace with.
I think that one of the reasons people sometimes don't know what to make of a poet is because most of the poets they meet are not poets all the time. They're like regular people who are doing, you know, making their bank statements tally and things like that. But some people are poets all the time. I have the feeling that you're one. I know that John Ashbery is. I know that it was once more possible. I have the feeling that Keats was a poet all the time. And some people live in the world. Like I know from your books that you discovered a writer that we've paid tribute to again and again on Bookworm, Robert Walser. And I think that he was a poet all the time, with the consequence that he was frequently called a madman. Is it possible, really, to be a poet all the time? How do you manage it?
I don't know if I'm a poet all the time. It seems, what's that famous Jim Harrison line? I'm the bird, not the ornithologist. That's for the ornithologist to decide. But I will say this, I try to be myself all the time. And that in itself is difficult in today's world and in our particular culture. And it may be that when one is oneself all of the time, they're being a poet. I like to be all eyes and I like to be all ears, but I also, you know, like to think. I like to be in the moment, but, oh dear, my mind's a sieve and I'm on the radio. Let us go to the sea in a sieve.
I've been talking with Mary Ruffel. Her book, Selected Poems, has been published recently by Wave Books. Thank you, Mary, for joining me. I've loved this.
Thank you, Michael. It was a great honor and pleasure to be on Bookworm.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.